Muqtada al-Sadr may be the most powerful political figure in Iraq today. To the Western media, he's known as the enigmatic young firebrand cleric who leads the 70,000-strong Shia militia called the Mahdi Army. But to Iraqi Shia, he's much, much more, the latest in a storied line of religious heroes who have long battled against tyranny in Mesopotamia. Journalist Patrick Coburn has spent much of the last 5 years reporting unembedded from Iraq, a country he's covered since the late 70s, for the British newspaper The Independent. And now he's written a new book called Muqtada. He joins us now. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
So your book opens with this pretty scary introduction to Muqtada and his followers. You're in a car in Iraq on your way to the holy city of Najaf when you get stopped by the Mahdi Army militiamen who accuse you of being an American spy. Will you describe what happened?
Yes, it was a very low moment in my life. There was a lot of fighting between Muqtada's forces, the Mahdi Army, and U.S. Marines at the Shia holy city of Najaf, south of Baghdad. And I decided to go there. I sort of made a mistake. I thought the danger was from, there are a number of Sunni Arab towns and villages that are very dangerous on the road. So I was wearing a disguise in, well, an Arab headdress, red and white Czech headdress. But in fact, the danger wasn't there. But when I ran into a Mahdi Army checkpoint at Kufa outside Najaf, and they tore the headdress off. They were in a fairly hysterical mood because they'd been fighting that morning, and they started screaming, "American spy, American spy." I was with two Iraqis who were trying to talk to them, but they thought that that was it, they were going to kill us. And just at the last moment when they, one of them said, "Well, let's check with our sheikh, let's check with our leader." And then they I was still on under arrest, so to speak. They took us off to the nearby mosque, and obviously I survived. Eventually we talked them around.
Did you think you were going to die in that moment?
Sure, yes. I laugh because it's, you know, something that happened in the past, but first of all, it's extremely frightening. Second, remember, you know, that tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have died in exactly similar circumstances.
Right.
That Iraqis dread these checkpoints because you don't know who's going to be there. The guys in uniform, but who do they really work for, you know? Thousands of people have been killed because they were Sunni and a Shia checkpoint or vice versa. So there was nothing, you know, what happened to me was nothing out of the ordinary except I survived.
Now, you've covered Iraq for a long time, more than 25 years. How much did you know about Muqtada al-Sadr before the fall of Saddam?
Not much. I knew about his family, but they'd mostly been wiped out by Saddam. I didn't realize that there was a survivor and also a politically astute survivor. I knew that his father and his two brothers had been assassinated by Saddam's gunmen in Najaf in 1999. His father really established the movement that Muqtada took over. And I knew that his father-in-law and cousin had been executed by Saddam in 1980. So I thought the family had basically been wiped out. Then suddenly Muqtada reemerged, to everybody's surprise. But the reason he became so important so fast was he inherited the organization and above all the credibility, the semi-divine status in the eyes of millions of Shia that his father and father-in-law had enjoyed.
Would you say that he took the consolidation of power to the next level after the assassination of his father?
Well, he's never really consolidated the movement. It's very sort of fragmented and therefore rather dangerous. Like my experience at the checkpoint, you have people who call themselves Sadrists, Mahdi Army, but they may be out of control. They may be completely out of control and, you know, they might be bands of criminals using it as an umbrella, or they might be sort of core units who would fight very hard. So he's trying at the moment, he says, to consolidate the movement so it's organized and disciplined. But at the stage I was running into them, no, it was very fragmented. And to a degree, that's still true to this day.
Now, you mentioned you were somewhat surprised to find out there was a survivor. And you write about how Muqtada survived by persuading Saddam, after Saddam killed his father and brothers, that Muqtada was too simple-minded to be a threat?
Sure. I mean, Saddam killed anybody who was a threat. So somebody who came from such a potentially powerful family, they were watching him the whole time. And I talked to people who were sort of around him at that time, and they said they just didn't dare do anything. And they told Muqtada that, you know, just keep absolutely quiet, don't have contact with anybody that might make them suspicious. So he was basically under house arrest in Najaf. And probably the reason they didn't kill him is that they thought there'd been an explosion of anger after his father was killed, a sort of doomed uprising, that they thought this would happen again if they killed Muqtada.
And you say he's no maverick either, despite the Western media's, you know, penchant for describing him as a firebrand. What is he really like?
I think, first of all, he's politically very experienced. He was his sort of father's aide. He ran his father's office, ran his magazine. So he has lots of more experience of street politics in Iraq than any other leader. Also, somebody who is very suspicious that he's going to be trapped, that he's going to be attacked. And this may have been, I mean, Iraq is a very dangerous place. His brother-in-law was assassinated last Friday. He is a very suspicious person and also keeps his own counsel. Somebody said to me, you know, you can be sitting beside Muqtada at meetings and everything else, and you never know what's going on inside his brain.
What do you think he's trying to accomplish? What is his message?
Well, he's an Islamic leader. Shia Islamic leader. He's a leader of the poor. But above all, what makes him different, let's say, from the government parties around the Iraqi prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, they're also religious parties, is his opposition to the American presence, which has been consistent over the last 5 years. You know, it's been a journalistic cliche, really, for the last 5 years, talking about him in the U.S. and foreign media as the renegade cleric. Mm-hmm. I don't know why renegade, because he hasn't changed sides or anything, or maverick, firebrand. These terms don't mean too much. But actually, his track record is of caution, not overcommitting himself. During the latest fighting, very heavy fighting in Basra and Baghdad, just when his people seemed to be winning, he suddenly called a ceasefire. So he's somebody who doesn't like to overplay his hand.
You recently reported that the Iraqi government has decided that the moment has come to crush the Mehdi army and the followers of Muqtada al-Sadr once and for all. What do you think is going to happen?
I think that we've just seen the first round of fighting between the government and Muqtada supporters. I think there'll be another round. And in private, this is what government ministers are saying in Baghdad. I think we're seeing also something which is very important, that which perhaps hasn't got enough publicity yet, which is really the last 5 years, the U.S. in Iraq has been fighting the Sunni community. I mean, all the guerrilla attacks are based on the Sunni Arab community in Iraq. Now, for the first time, it's fighting a very large chunk of the Shia community, which is much larger. This is a pretty massive change for the U.S. in Iraq. It's really the beginning of another war, which is rather different from the one the U.S. forces have been fighting since 2003.
Do you think he's more powerful than President al-Maliki and the central government?
Yes, he is, because at the end of the day, he has people who will fight to the death for them, for him. And we saw that recently in the fighting. You know that the Prime Minister Maliki said that all militiamen in Basra should be disarmed in 72 hours. And what Iraqis saw on television was, in fact, the Iraqi army handing over its weapons to the Mehdi army militiamen, not vice versa.
Patrick, after having spent so much of your life in Iraq, what does your crystal ball say? What do you think is going to happen? Is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, there's not too much, no. I mean, nobody has got what they want yet. I mean, there are elements which maybe people don't realize, which is two governments in the world fully support the government in Baghdad at the moment. One is the United States and the other is Iran. The Iranians think this government is about as good as it's going to get because it's Shia religious parties. So at some point there is the basis for an agreement between Iran and the U.S., as the Iraqi government itself keeps saying, and keeps on trying to arrange meetings. But also, you know, you have to take Iraq as it is. You have to deal with people like Muqtada, whether you're the United States or the Iraqi government, because they have a great deal of support. You can't just ignore them, or, as now they're saying, you know, he'll not be allowed to take part in the elections because he has militia. Actually, all parties there have militias. But if you try to marginalize or ignore people who really are very important and have big constituencies, then you're just going to prolong the violence and your opponents are not going to go out of business just because you don't like them.
Patrick, thank you so much for joining us, and please stay as safe as possible.
Thank you very much.
Patrick Coburn is the Iraq correspondent for The Independent in London. His new book is called Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq. For more about him, please visit our website, morefairgame.org.